College campuses nationwide are seeing an increase in students reaching out for psychological help. This age has always been sort of pivotal in a person's mental health trajectory. It's a pretty typical age of onset for a lot of conditions, but how do you explain the spike in interest in counseling? Have the stresses on people in their 20s changed? Or is it a change in the culture around asking for help? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about mental health in your 20s. My first guest is Johanna Jarko. She's a professor of psychology at Temple University. Johanna, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So why do so many psychological issues just generally seem to rear their heads when people are in their early 20s?
I think that's a really great question, and it's something that we're very interested in. It's a time where you have changes both in terms of your biology, but also in terms of your social context. So many times you are being exposed to social situations that are more complex, more fraught than you maybe have ever experienced before. And just as that's happening, you do start to see these symptoms come on board. So like social anxiety, depressive disorders, that's really when they're at their peak.
You said that there was a biological piece of this, and I'm curious about that.
Sure. There are changes in the brain that happen all throughout development. And in the last 10 years or so, we've discovered that these changes, they continue on up until your mid-20s and maybe even further beyond that. And these changes in brain function are often in the regions of the brain that are associated with trying to do sort of more complex thinking about things and complex learning about things. So if you're in a more complicated social context, that may begin to be more challenging for you if you're not necessarily having the best development at that time.
So when you say that the situations people are in their early 20s are also more complex and fraught, can you describe what you mean by that?
Sure. We're talking about college. So many times when students go away to college, they're living alone for the first time. They are maybe living in a room with a stranger that they've never met before. They have to balance responsibilities that they maybe haven't had to do for themselves before, like getting assignments in on time, trying to balance the amount of time that you spend socializing when you maybe don't have a parent telling you that you need to be home at a certain time. And it's just a higher level of responsibility. And on top of that, a lot of college students have a tremendous amount of financial responsibility that comes along with them attending a college. So that adds additional stressors.
You know, you mentioned that we're talking about college here, but not all 20-somethings are in college. Does the picture look different for them?
That's a really good question. So many of the studies that have been done have been looking more at college students, but there are wider studies that look more at a population base. And you are seeing similar kinds of increases in rates of anxiety and depression. So again, this is a transition time when many people move away from their parents' home. They might have to be financially responsible for themselves for the first time as well. A lot of people are helping out their families with their financial responsibilities too. So I think regardless of whether you go to college or not, you're sort of transitioning away from a pretty tightly controlled social situation to one in which there are a lot more variables that are at play.
What is the research that kind of illuminates this phenomenon? You mentioned that people are really interested in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have been several really large studies that have been conducted, not just in the United States, but internationally, that are looking at just rates of onset. And what they're finding is very similar to what you said, that you know you can have as many as 1 in 3 or 1 in 5 individuals starting to have signs of psychopathology in your 20s. And a few of the things that are associated with that are having psychopathology when you're younger. So many times the type of mental health problems that we see in 20-year-olds might have started when the individual was 14 or 15. And so they might just be reaching out for help for the first time in their 20s when their symptoms are maybe interfering with their ability to perform in their job, with their ability to do what they need to do.
Or maybe when they just don't have... setting. Maybe when they're finally in the position of doing that for themselves?
Yes, Exactly. So when they're feeling empowered, and you know, I think people have worked really hard to try to destigmatize seeking mental help, help for mental health issues. And so perhaps once you're out of kind of a more confined environment in high school, you have broader opportunities that are available to you in different kinds of resources.
Because I could imagine, you know, if you're in high school and you have to tell your parent, you would have to tell your parents you wanted to go get help before you got the help. And that with mental health issues could be challenging.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that that's a really good point. And so if we can continue to sort of empower people to seek that help and to give them resources, I think that that's a really critical next step. Because you're not sort of in the same infrastructure that you might be in high school, where there's a very specific person that, like a guidance counselor that you go to. And making those resources more available to people in their 20s, I think is definitely important.
Is it possible, though, because this, so there are two issues here. One is the incidence of depression or anxiety or whatever mental health issue we're talking about. And then another piece of it is the actual reaching out for help. So is it possible to know what a change in the number of people reaching out actually means? As in, do we know whether people are experiencing mental health issues in higher numbers or if there are just fewer people trying to tough it out or whatever? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's like a chicken and egg problem. You really don't know. I think that a lot of people might be feeling more comfortable on a survey, for instance, saying that they have a mental health problem as they might not have been in the past. So it's really hard to disentangle self-report biases or the change in the number of people who are seeking mental health assistance versus the amount who are actually experiencing that. And I think that that is a question that's really difficult to answer. And in some ways, it maybe that's not the most important question to ask. If people are experiencing these symptoms, that's the thing that we have to best address. And so I think that focusing on that is a really critical thing to do.
When you hear that the number of college students seeking psychological support on campus through like on-campus services is going up. Mm-hmm. What do you think that might tell us about the population that's the same age, you know, early 20s, that's not on a campus with that social safety net of readily available services? Are there implications that people are talking about for that population?
So in terms of kids who are not on college campuses, is
yeah,
that what you mean?
And just not in that position to be like, oh, yeah, what I do about this is I reach out to the office on campus where they deal with this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that the fact that there are more resources available in the community is really important. And I think that people who are in that circumstance, they have a much tougher job of it for the reasons that you just said. It's not a structured environment. You don't have a pamphlet that tells you exactly who to contact when you're having a challenge. Many professors are in a position where they're encouraged or even mandated to contact mental health services if they notice a substantial change in one of their students. Whereas outside of those circumstances, is you don't necessarily have that same safety net. So the fact that people are reaching out and are able to find those resources is really a really wonderful thing and a very important thing.
I want to bring Beth Epley in on this. She's a counselor here in town at Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
So can you explain, first of all, what you do on campus? Because your role in understanding what's going on with the young people seeking help there is very interesting to me.
I spend most of my time in individual therapy sessions with our students. We have medical students, and then we have master's students in our College of Bioscience and PsyD students. We do some outreach programming and a little bit of group support, but primarily individual counseling.
So what is your sense of why people in their 20s are vulnerable to these mental health stresses?
Well, I think, as was already said, the biological component, that the brain is still changing significantly. And then there are so many environmental stressors. I mean, friendships are often shifting and changing. The people you've counted on in the past, maybe the connection from those people in high school feels differently now. There's a reckoning that's often happening with the child becoming an adult and wanting to renegotiate that relationship with parents. And I think even in families where that transition happens pretty smoothly, it's still an adjustment. And then finally, there is this steep learning curve. I mean, what you're doing day to day, whether it's college or a new job or something else, there's a learning curve, and that's stressful. I mean, we can remember being that age, and so much of the time you're having to wing it. And so,
yeah, it's like adulthood is like a foreign country at first.
Mm-hmm. And you're
faking
it.
Or maybe forever.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think when you put all of those together, it becomes easier to see, while it's such an exciting time too, that mental health problems could crop up.
Would you say that from your observation, I mean, how long have you been doing this work?
I have been at Kansas City University for 4 years, and prior to that, I was the director of counseling services at William Jewell College for about 9 years. So
in the time you've been doing this, have you seen changes either in the kinds of stresses people are bringing to you or in the culture around asking for help?
I think I see improve. I mean, I think it's getting easier for people to reach out for help. I'm lucky to work on a campus where we have a lot of wellness initiatives and you know, student wellness council. So there's opportunity again and again and again to be able to say to students, reaching out is a good thing. I feel like some of the, especially for males, sometimes I think it's been harder to reach out and ask for help. And I see some of those differences getting better. When I have students now and they have kind of an internalized stigma about mental health, sadly, sometimes it's coming from some family messages, but I don't see it coming much from peers. So that's a good thing.
With the increase in demand for college counseling services just across the country, there's also been this companion issue of not being able to meet all the demand. What's the situation on your campus right now as far as that goes?
We stay very busy. We have two counselors, and we're busy. We see more students than we used to see. We're getting help and support and trying to meet those needs. And the same was true at William Jewell. By the time I left, I looked recently. I think I started off with 40-some clients and left with 129.
Wow.
I mean, not at one time, but over a semester or something. But so.
And was that pretty typical for your colleagues as well?
Yes. Yep.
So it's not just that you're like the most amazing one.
Well, there is that. I was going to mention that.
What do you guys talk about how to address the demand and what it signifies?
We do. You know, we talk about, are there ways to, you know, do you go to 30-minute sessions? Do you meet students every other week? Trying to get better. How do we give students tools to use on their own? I mean, there are wonderful apps and things like that, but I don't think anything takes the place of that one-on-one contact.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about mental health in your 20s on college campuses and beyond. Call 816-235-2888 if you go to a local school or you're just around lots of people in their 20s. What's your insight into how this is playing out in your community? When we return, a young person who's active in the National Alliance for Mental Illness on a local college campus. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about mental health in your 20s. According to a 2018 report from the American College Health Association, more than 60% of college students said they had experienced overwhelming anxiety in the past year. We've been talking about why. Call 816-235-2888 to join the discussion. We're joined now by a student at UMKC who has some insight into this. Aneva Jefferson, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So you have been active in an advocacy group with the UMKC chapter, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. What inspired you to get involved in that?
Yeah, so I personally struggle with mental health issues, and I know so many other people who do. And I saw the benefits of asking for help and reaching out and wanted to give other people the opportunity to do the same.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about why you feel that requires some level of advocacy?
Yeah, so we've talked a little bit about stigma, internalized stigma, and also societal stigma on asking for help and reaching out. And I think stigma plays a huge role in people not wanting to ask for help or reach out. And I think clubs like NAMI are important because it allows people to see that it's okay to ask for help and reach out and talk about mental health issues that maybe before they didn't think was okay to discuss.
What do you think of the conversation all of us older people have been having about you and people your age and what stresses you out and why you do or don't reach out for help? What do you think of that conversation?
I think it's completely valid and accurate. College is hard, and your early 20s is hard, even if you're not in college. There's so much change, and there's so much to be stressed about and to figure out. And sometimes you feel like you're all alone in this struggle, and that's why things like NAMI are important, because you realize you're not alone in this struggle.
Can you describe a situation that you or one of your friends has encountered recently that has really just like puts an exclamation point on, like, this is the kind of stuff we are dealing with, in case you old people forgot?
That's a good question. I have a roommate that is in pharmacy school, and they have a test almost every week, and are dealing with relationship issues and are trying to figure out where they're going to live next year. And so all of that is kind of overwhelming, especially if you haven't dealt with these types of stressors before, and just trying to navigate through all of that and balance it all.
You know what I remember being just especially stressful at that age is that you, like, right now I can have every kind of stressful situation, but I basically know, like, I don't want to say where I've ended up in life, but, like, I know that I have a career, and I know, you know what I mean? Like, you don't know that yet. You know, like, I just think not knowing what the future holds for you, but being so focused on trying to attain it, is really a tough combo.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Like we've said many times, this time in our lives is such a transitional period, and we don't really know what's next for us. And that's scary. And again, we feel like we're the only ones feeling that way, and we're supposed to have it all figured out, and none of us do.
Do you think this is about college and what college is like right now, or do you think it's bigger than that, this whole rise in seeking help?
I think it's bigger than that. I think as a whole, it's easier to start conversations surrounding mental health, not just on college campuses, even though there are a lot of advocacy events and informational events held on campuses. I think as a whole, it's getting easier to reach out for help and talk about mental health issues.
What do you suspect is new for your generation, and what do you think is just part of growing up in our culture?
I think something that's new that I've noticed is that there's a push for, I don't know, this phrase, it's okay to not be okay. And I think that's a really important and valid statement, because we're supposed to, or we feel as if we're supposed to have it all together and have it all figured out, and we're supposed to be happy. And that's not the case. It's not the case for anyone at all, no matter what your age is. But I think the statement, it's okay to not be okay, is kind of confusing at first, because we feel as if we're supposed to be. And but if you really think about it, it's so validating for someone who maybe isn't feeling the best at the moment, or has before and don't know why they aren't anymore.
That this isn't some statement of, like, you and how you are. This is just part of being human.
Yes.
Johanna Jarko of Temple University, chime in here. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, this sounds very familiar. This sounds like what I hear my students talk about all the time. And we forget that this is a time when often, well, hopefully not that often, parents start to get sick. I have a student who emailed me this morning that her mother was stage 4 cancer. The father just died. I mean, there's like a lot of stuff that goes on. And I think that that's been around forever. And I think that when we're sort of looking for, it's sort of like we're looking for the answer. And I don't think that there is the answer. I think it's a confluence of things that makes it really challenging for people in that age range. I think that a lot of people are sort of looking for a magic bullet with social media, for instance. And I think that social media can actually be very beneficial in terms of providing social support, especially if you're feeling isolated from not having new friends when you have moved to a new location, for instance.
So, like, a way to stay connected.
Exactly. A way to stay connected. It's easy to quickly text somebody. And there are a lot of this research is going on right now, but there are a few studies that are really tracking college students during that transition and tracking them in terms of their physical movement and the amount of social media that they engage in and their different social networks. And so I think in a couple of years, we're going to get a much more complex and nuanced picture of just what's going on. And I very much doubt that you're going to see a single cause. I think it's a very complex situation that we'll find.
Aside from social media, what are some of the things people are talking about as far as interventions go?
Yeah, people are trying to move to app-based interventions where you can kind of track people's mood and send them encouraging messages at different times.
Can you explain how that works? Because is it like that based on the person interacting with the app, or is it like reading biometric data type things?
So people are working on both types of technology. So, for instance, you can have like a daily diary, let's say, where you are rating your mood on some scale. And if you reach a certain threshold, you might receive an encouraging message back. Just something that provides you with some amount of support in that context. And then other types of technology is sort of looking at patterns and seeing if people who are using social media a lot and then suddenly kind of drop down, if they're moving around a lot, but suddenly they're not moving around a lot, all this information you can glean from your smartphone. So looking for these more complex patterns, and if you can identify them, then kind of reaching out to people or then notifying somebody if there's been a drastic change in behavior.
So Big Brother is watching, but Big Brother cares.
Big Brother might be watching. Yeah, Big Brother cares, right?
Yeah.
Big Brother could care. Big Brother could care. So it's an exciting time, and I think that there are a lot of different potential opportunities that will come out of the research that's going on right now. But I think we're not quite there yet.
Are the patterns around developmental psychology in 20-somethings the same across cultures, or does it look different in specifically 21st century America than it does in other places? We've already talked about other times, but what about other places? I am so curious about how much of this is a reflection of our culture in some sense.
Mm-hmm. I think that, again, it gets back to reporting issues, too. So across different cultures, you have different stigma levels about reporting. So I think that's always important to keep in mind. But in some of the large studies that have been done recently, and these are more across more of the developed countries that have similar sorts of SES as the U.S. does, you're not really seeing that big of differences across the different countries. But I think that maybe looks at a scale that is not quite the most important one. We have a lot of different cultures just within our country. And so you can think about the type of stigma that you would experience perhaps in, an affluent community where this is something that is talked about quite a bit versus a community where maybe you don't have the resources available and you've been exposed to a lot more experiences of trauma, that we know that early exposure to trauma can have profound impact on your lifetime mental health. So I think that even just looking within our different communities is a really important thing to do.
I want to talk to a caller at 816-235-2888. Emily is joining us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
So I am a counselor, a student counselor at the Community Counseling and Assessment Services at UMKC. And I just kind of wanted to share that they offer counseling to anyone in their 20s. They don't have to be a student, so if they're not plugged into a college or a university system that advertises counseling, we do accept anyone in the community, and it's a sliding scale so we can see people.
Okay, that is good information. Is there anything else you want to say about what you're hearing from your own personal perspective, just as someone with so much familiarity with the issues?
I mean, I think it's already really been addressed, but I just exited my 20s. And so I think the biggest thing is again, social media. I think there's also less stigma around counseling and receiving services, but then also kind of like I see students who feel, or even community members, who feel a pressure to kind of amount to something, but they don't have those resources. And I think that's just something in our society with the wage gap and just not being able to kind of fulfill those expectations that they have.
When you said that you think the biggest thing is social media, that could mean a lot of different things. Could you explain what you personally mean when you say that?
Yeah, so I think people tend to compare themselves with what people put on social media, which tends to be the best aspects of their life, or the most positive or most flattering. And so when people are kind of looking and they're seeing these pictures and these, you know, great romances and, you know, happy kids, happy families, they can tend to think that that's their life completely, and not really realize that, you know, there's an other side behind social media that may not be as happy. And so I think sometimes people tend to just focus on the happy side and not that it's normal to feel pain and it's normal to struggle. It's normal to feel depressed, but it's how, you know, how you work through those issues.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for that call.
Yeah, thank you. And the number for the CCAS, if they ever want
to call
for this.
I'm gonna interrupt you there because I don't suspect that our listeners are ready with a pen to jot that down,
okay.
But we will provide a link to information if it's available on your website when we post this audio later today. Thanks so much for the call, Emily.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks.
You know, I want to bring Beth Epley, who is a counselor at Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences, back in on this. Tell me more about the social media piece of it. We've heard a lot about what social media does. I'm interested in the absence of what it might be replacing. You know what I mean? Like the friendships where you do kind of move through physical life a little more together and therefore maybe see a more rounded picture of what your friends are going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think social media, you know, people still have the same underlying emotional issues and still want to love and be loved and feel a sense of belonging and feel like they have a voice that's heard. And now all of that kind of gets played out on social media, and it can be a wonderful way for people to connect. The downside of it is there is all of this self-comparison. And I'm really drawn to Kristen Neff's work on self-compassion, because in our field, we've focused so much on self-esteem. But that says, you know, I'm going to make it. I'm going to be good. I'm going to be a winner. I can succeed.
Which is still on that same model.
It is. And sometimes that happens and sometimes it doesn't. And so self-esteem kind of deserts you when you need it most, whereas self-compassion is sort of cultivating this relationship with yourself that says, I'm going to treat you with kindness and care, just like I would treat anyone else, regardless of how things are going.
What are you seeing on your campus that particularly concerns you as far when you think about the mental health of a generation?
I do think there is a level of perfectionism that's concerning. And there is, I really like to go back to what Aneva said about it's okay not to be okay. I think I end up working a lot with students on this idea that it's part of human life to suffer sometimes. And I think it feels so scary that our instant reaction is to want to avoid it or distract ourselves or numb ourselves with social media or food or something else. And so to be able to work on it, how do you sit with some of those uncomfortable feelings and just try to make a sanctuary for them? And actually, when you do that, interestingly, and you kind of shut down the story, but just sit with the feeling, they don't linger for as long.
What are you seeing that gives you hope?
I think that this, I don't know if it's this particular generation or just people in their 20s, but there is such a wisdom that goes along with that age. And these are young people who dream big. They sort of see the world whole. They have this absolute impatience with incompetence and injustice. And, you know, the downside of that can be that there's some vulnerability to cynicism when things don't work out. But the hope is that there's this gift to the world of solving big problems.
Our time is up, but Beth Epley, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Aneva Jefferson, thank you so much for being here in the studio with us and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Johanna Jarko, thanks for joining us from Temple University.
My pleasure.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, the game of chess is cool again, and some people think that could make a big difference for youth. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're talking about chess. The announcement from Mizzou that they're starting a competitive chess team is just the latest sign that the game, or sport, we'll discuss that distinction, is enjoying some renewed interest and popularity, especially in Missouri. We will find out why from our next guests. Christian Carrilla is the new MU chess coach. Hi, Christian.
Hi, Gina. Thank you for having me.
You are from Romania. Can you tell me about the role of chess in Romanian culture, like how you grew up with the game?
That is correct. Yes. So my father introduced me to chess. He's a chess coach as well. So you could say it runs in the family. I wouldn't say chess is very popular in Romania. We have soccer, which is extremely popular. Chess is kind of a very late string to that game. But, you know, I really enjoyed it from the beginning. And I became good at it at an early age. So that kind of fueled the fire and made me continue with this passion. And that kind of was my life.
Kinda. You are a chess grandmaster, so I would say so. What does it mean to be a chess grandmaster?
So this is the final level in chess, like a black belt in karate or jiu-jitsu or whatnot. But even after you reach this level, there are still differentiations, and that is in the rating. That is a point system that determines how good you are, how good you played against your opponents, and so on. It can drop, it can go up, and so on. So in order to get the Grandmaster title, you need to reach three norms. You need to achieve three norms. And you do so by playing in very strong events, international events. You need to face an array of grandmasters from different countries. You cannot face only from one country. You need to have, I believe, four nationalities in one of these tournaments, and you need to perform at a level of 2,600 plus. So it's very difficult, and you need to do that three times before you reach this this grandmaster level and you get your title. A lot of people manage to do this twice, and then they stop there and never get the title.
That's tragic.
I know it is tragic, and you know sometimes people waste, you could say, their whole lives on that. I was lucky to get it at an early age, and nowadays a lot of youngsters are getting it even earlier. A lot of 12-year-olds are getting the Grandmaster title nowadays. So there's this boom of interest and of skill in chess.
And it sounds like maybe obsession level.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, I am curious, do you think of chess as a game or a sport? And I wonder what your sense of the difference is, because the idea that Mizzou is getting a competitive chess team in the same way that you would have like a tennis team or a football team is super interesting to me. There's no such thing as like a checkers team.
Absolutely. No, I believe 100% that that chess is a sport. And there have been studies made on it. You know, they put heart monitors on players and so on, and it seems like during one game you can burn up to like 1,000 calories. This is just the scientific, I would say, backup. But at the same time, it's competition. It's very, very difficult competition. You're sitting at the board for 5, 6, 7 hours at a time, and you're trying to outmatch your opponent in terms of mental skill, ideas, and so on. And this can take a toll on you, definitely physically. So there's this influx of very, very fit chess players nowadays. And you can see that with Magnus Carlsen, who is the current world champion. He works out on a regular basis. He likes to post about it. He even likes to brag about it. He feels like it's his identity. So definitely a lot of chess players nowadays are identifying themselves as very, very fit individuals.
Can you tell me about your hopes for the team at Mizzou?
Yeah, so definitely I'm hoping to fight for the championship in the first year. Of course, I'm going to get 4 grandmasters, and hopefully that's going to help with that. It's not going to be easy. The competition is fierce. There's a lot of universities that are having well-established programs. And nevertheless, I believe Mizzou is going to bring some new blood to the table, I would say. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, what made you want to be coaching a chess team here? Like, what about the program or the school or the setting? Like, what made this a good fit for you? What is your excitement about?
So I studied in Dallas at one of the universities that offered chess scholarships, and I felt I missed something. I don't want to attack them personally by any means. It's a great program, but at the same time, I felt I missed this competitiveness, and I feel Mizzou has that. That point of excellence because of their athletic teams, because how good they are in the nation, because of the fact that they're the biggest state university. And you don't see that in universities that offer chess scholarships. So I think this is going to be the differentiator that's going to attract students at Mizzou and are going to offer a full American college experience to the national and international students that are going to join the chess team.
So you were saying that you were seeing like these very fit chess players coming up on the scene, and that you're seeing younger and younger people become grandmasters. Would you say that chess is generally becoming more popular in the U.S., or is that a separate question?
No, absolutely. There's a huge boom in U.S. chess, and mostly because of an individual named Rex Sinfield, who has created the St. Louis Chess
Club.
Yes.
Also,
yes,
someone who funds a lot of politicians, generally Republican politicians.
Correct. Yes. I actually don't know much about his political affiliations, but I do know him as a great ambassador for chess. He started the St. Louis Chess Club, I think, in 2007, I want to say. And he improved the chess scene. He brought the best chess players in the world and in the United States all together with very generous prize funds for the U.S. championships. And he moved the needle for the past decade. He is also the one that is helping put this program together at Mizzou. So I think a lot of it belongs to him. A lot of the credit belongs to him. At the same time, a lot of the credit belongs to the internet and the fact that the information and chess and the fact that you can play online 100 games per day if you want, that also helps a lot. And you see a lot of youth playing on the internet, following these top tournaments on YouTube, on Twitch, on all these platforms. And I believe this access to information also helped chess as a whole, not only in the United States, but as a whole, develop and become more accessible to everybody.
Well, my next guest is Lee Bohannon. He is from Link, where they started a program teaching chess in public schools that were struggling. And this is before chess was cool again, right, Lee?
Yes.
Tell me the story of bringing chess to Kansas City school kids. What inspired it, and what did you experience?
Well, thanks, Gina, for having us here. We had at Blenheim Elementary School, when the Kansas City, Missouri School District was struggling for academia, we had a group called Men on the Move that worked at Blenheim. It was a group of men that went to the school to volunteer at the school to help with young men with difficulties that they were having. And my grandson was living with me at the time, and he drugged me into a Donuts for Dad, saying, "Dad, you just gotta go here." And we went to the Donuts for Dads, and out of that started chess, began to work, because one of four of the young men that was having trouble at the school, we talked with the principal, and he allowed us to begin working with them with chess instead of going into the ISS room. They became so enthused with chess, their behavior changed, their grades got better, and literally they started a group at Blenheim called the Blenheim Cadets, and chess was off and running from there.
What
What was it like to introduce chess to young people, and what did you see in them? What did you see come out in them as a result?
It was in introducing chess to them. I learned chess in the late 60s. Bernard Powell, who's the president of Social Action Committee 20, he taught us all to play chess, thinking at the time.
Hold on. He's like a very famous local civil rights leader. And
yes.
When you say he taught all of us how to play chess, who do you mean?
We had a group that I worked with at the time was called the Social Action Committee of 20, SAC 20, and Bernard was the president. He was a young man, but he was very creative, very out with thinking. And his brother, who was a local artist, that taught him to play. And then when he learned to play, he was like, all of the board of SAC 20 really need to learn how to play chess, because it'll help us with the thinking, it'll help us with making decisions about things they would do in our community. And the whole board, when I say all of us, I mean the board of directors of SAC 20, which in turn taught members of our family and community members. So
how old were you when you were part of this?
I was 23 and 68, so when I first touched the chessboard the first time, it was probably 24.
Do you think it did influence your thinking and your approach to problem solving?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Likewise, when I see young adults now, not only young adults, but young elementary school children, there have been situations where there have been children with serious attention disorder, and they begin to play chess. And things begin to happen in the mind. Literally, we believe that the brain rewires itself based on the number of decisions that you make, the choices that are made through playing chess. It happened to me at an older age, but I clearly began to look at things where I can plan out things a little better. At that time, I was just a young man getting into the civil rights movement with the group. But I began to look at things from what comes next. What is the best decision to make at this time? And things like that. And it moved into my private life. And I began to talk to my family about it. I talked to all of my children to play chess. And it became a good communication tool between me, my family, and community folks.
When you have gone into schools, can you tell me some stories? I mean, your story is amazing. What are some stories you've witnessed?
Well, one, as a matter of fact, thanks for asking. I put a couple of down here. Number one is that there was a young lady at a school that could not make it through a particular chess game. Every time she get in a game, and we found out, her parents told us that she had difficulty completing things that she starts, she'd get frustrated and so forth. So her parents began to bring them the chess and stay close by and work with her. And believe me now, Gina, the last chess tournament that we were in, she played through the tournament, won, and was able to stop and to analyze how a game went, what did she do that she could have done better. And it was amazing. It gets emotional sometimes, some of the things. Another thing, there was a young lady that did not go to one of our schools. She went to a local church, and she was like in probably the third grade. And she told her dad that she did not want to play with the third graders. She wanted to play up. Maybe she was a little older than third grade. And she played a young man that was a middle schooler. And when they found out that she was playing up and she was playing a middle schooler, all of the middle school guys start pointing at him, "Oh, you're playing a baby. Look at you. You're going to have to play a little kid." And this young lady, in the very probably the first 8 or 10 moves, she got him in a position so he did not know what to do, and she won, and it was one of the most remarkable things that I had ever seen, and it got these guys to know that just because a young lady is small and in a lesser grade, it doesn't mean that she can't do what she need to do.
Right on. When you at Link decided, you know, it sounds like your passion for this is personal and it comes from your own experience.
What was the motivation for a community organization to go into schools and start teaching chess? What was the bigger picture idea there?
Gina, I would have to believe that you would always want to say that the thing that you did, but when it became apparent what chess was doing at Blenheim, literally the principal began putting chess boards in the classrooms and working with students in the classroom, and our executive director, Gail Hobbs, saw the action that was happening there and saw the necessity for it and began to say that Link will embrace chess. And she worked out so that we could go to another. I believe we first went to 5 schools, and we had our first chess tournament at Chick when Chick was over at 51st Street. And we went to Chick, and then the next we went to 10 schools. And now we are in 39, I believe, schools, charter schools and private schools in the metro area in 5 school districts.
You know, do you get the feeling that with some of these kids, that the taste of success they get in chess, that translates to other things?
Oh, absolutely. There are any number of situations that has shown that what a child learns with chess. I guess one of the things is reading. Reading is a top subject around the country now. There are very few chess players that enjoy and embrace chess that can't read, because the same exact skill set that it takes for reading takes for chess. And once you play a game of chess, you get literally thousands of decisions that are made in every single chess game. And when you find yourself being...
You're reading a board.
Yes. Not only you're reading a board, but you're reading the things that is in your mind before you move and before the opponent moves.
So it's that similarly like non-passive... following of a story.
Absolutely. You get immediate response back from sometimes children work and they do something as well and they look for attention back and they don't get it because there's no one adult or anything
around.
I never thought about this,
but like also then the chess pieces are kind of like letters that form words. There is a kind of literacy with symbols.
And absolutely. You create pictures and I guess we have a chess master on here. I've never been in front and he can probably verify chess. There are a lot of pictures that develop in your mind, and children begin to recognize those pictures, and you begin to recognize how that picture manipulated would take you further into the game. So when children begin to look at things like that, and they want to look at how to start their game or stop again, you have to be able to annotate the game. You have to be able to write down your moves, write down the opponent's moves, so just in case the game gets going.
I want to go back to our chess grandmaster and future MU chess coach, because I'm curious whether, you know, as you see kids coming into the college level of chess, do they tend to be like also standout students academically, or is there no relationship?
The level that I'm looking on right now, which is the grandmaster level, because those are the guys that I'm trying to recruit, there is not a strong correlation. Because very often they miss a lot of school. They are professionals going into high school and almost into college. For example, I myself, I was not going to go to college. I was considering the professional lifestyle of a chess player. And before I received the offer from the United States College, and I came here and I accepted it. But a lot of these students are very focused on chess, so they miss a lot of school because they have to travel to tournaments and so on. But at the same time, they can be very much focused on one specific task. This is an ability that chess players generally have. So if you're going to ask them to study, and if you're going to take away all distractions, they're going to be able to focus on that specific task. And I think being a chess player and being able to externalize all other distractions is definitely a skill that's going to help them with their studies as well.
Well, thanks so much, Christian Kurila. Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Gina. Thank you for having me.
Christian is a chess grandmaster from Romania. He's been named coach of MU's brand new competitive chess team. And Lee Bohannon, thank you. Are you excited that chess, you've played chess when it was cool, then after it was cool, and now when it's cool again?
I am very excited, and my greatest excitement is seeing it grow and seeing, especially with seeing children in areas where they don't have everything, they can have something that they can do that they feel proud of.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
And thank you, Gina.
You can listen to any of the conversations you didn't catch in their entirety at kcur.org/Central Standard. They'll be there by the end of the day. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.